Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
A rogue agent takes matters into his own hands and the CIA swings into action.
He had an assignment. He failed. He obviously felt compelled to finish the task. We think he'll come back in now. Like behavioral software. It's following a protocol. Now that he's completed the mission, we think he'll come back in. They always do. Then what?
I told you we'd clean this up. It will be clean.
What would Hollywood do if the CIA ever cleaned up its reputation? What would the Justice Department do to clean things up at Langley? Precious little, according to a new report.
It's routine. It's like behavioral software. It's following a protocol.
Behavioral software looking for an upgrade that won't crash the system. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's a Born Identity Monday, August 24th. I'm John Hockenberry here with our very own Femi Okay. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning, John. Good morning, all.
So this hour, the history of vacations,
right.
Presidential vacations, mm-hmm. That is. Also, a spike in the number of women caught drinking and driving. It's a family issue, it turns out. And the Obama administration has less than half of its administration hired at this point, part of the Monday morning agenda. But first, to talk about yet another CIA report on abuses by agents and interrogators to be released as early as today, Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, joins us. Siobhan, what is the threshold for actual accountability, prosecutions for Bush administration abuses at the CIA? Will this report push it to that?
It's not clear yet. I think that we'll have to see exactly what the specific details are. And then the Attorney General actually has to make a decision as to whether or not he wants to launch an investigation. After that investigation, then he would decide whether there would be prosecution. So we're several steps away from that, and it's not clear even whether the Attorney General is actually going to do it, but it looks like he probably will.
Well, more on the details of that report. Siobhan is going to stay with us. First, everything you need to know this morning.
As we wait for the CIA report, the Justice Department is recommending that nearly a dozen prisoner abuse cases be reopened. That news comes from our partner, the New York Times, and it also reverses decisions by the Bush administration and could expose some CIA employees to prosecution. And there's also news that the president has approved the creation of a new FBI unit of interrogators to question key terrorism suspects. The Washington Post reports that this will shift oversight from the CIA to the White House.
New concerns about the war in Afghanistan. U.S. military commanders there say they don't have enough troops to do their job. Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, told CNN that the Taliban insurgency has gotten better and more sophisticated in its tactics. Back in the U.S., it's go time if you're hoping to cash in on one of those Cash for Clunkers rebates. The program ends at 8 p.m. Eastern. That's 2 weeks ahead of schedule. Just ran out of money. Only the second time in history. It happened yesterday. The Philadelphia Phillies second baseman Eric Bruntlett pulled off an unassisted triple play. That's 1-2-3 outs in one play to win the game against the New York Mets. The last game-ending unassisted triple play was in 1927. It's fair to say that it pretty much broke the heart of the Mets yesterday. Yes, Mets fans were sobbing yesterday, or just in shock. Markets closed up more than 1% on Friday. The Dow opens next hour at 95.06. Looks like a positive opening when Wall Street gets going. And the S&P starts trading at 10.26, the NASDAQ at 20.21. Cash for Clunkers ends today. It means you haven't been lured into the car dealerships. What would it take for you to cash in your clunker? Tell us an incentive that would work for you. 877 78MyTake or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here, host joined this morning by Femi Okay.
Good morning, John. Good morning, all.
And accountability.
Right.
I think it's fair to say accountability is the issue that they're thinking about over at the CIA this morning for a couple of reasons, actually more than just a couple of reasons. First of all, the Justice Department's ethics office has apparently recommended reopening nearly a dozen prison abuse cases that involve CIA interrogators, and the recommendation reverses the Bush administration, which had suggested it didn't want to prosecute. And the recommendation comes as a CIA Inspector General's report, a widely anticipated report that may be released as early as today. It's expected to shine new light on harsh interrogation tactics used at CIA secret prisons. Here's Newsweek reporter Michael Isikoff talking about some of the revelations that he reports about in an August 21st Newsweek online piece.
All expectations are that a declassified version of the report will be released on Monday. It will still contain redactions, but what's in the half that is going to be publicly released is going to be pretty explosive.
Well, that depends on who it is that's the explosion is likely to hit. Joining us again is Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We've also got Art Keller, a former CIA case officer. He served in Pakistan in 2006. Art Keller, Michael Isikoff can say this will be an explosive report, and it makes him look good as a reporter. But in terms of what we've already seen from the CIA, how do you rate what it is we're likely to see?
Well, that's tough to say, but if the new allegations pan out, all the harsh tactics are horrific, but it's hard to say how they're materially different from, for instance, waterboarding. It's all intended to put someone in fear for their life. So whether you're doing that by threatening to shoot someone or waterboard someone, I don't really see a great difference in degree. It's a horrific tactic, and it never should have been used, but it's not really materially different. It just appears to me that one was on an authorized list and another wasn't. But once you head down the road of authorizing the use of harsh tactics, it is inevitable that something like this is going to happen.
Now, this is a behavior that occurred as early as 2002. Is it the actual tactics that are more disturbing and more subject to prosecution, or a pattern of abuses that may have suggested that the CIA officially condoned this sort of thing?
I think they're both disturbing, but I would not limit the pattern of abuses simply to the CIA. Any investigation, if it were going to truly cover this matter, would have to go in three directions. It would have to start at the people who authorized it, which would be the White House, the people who provided the legal justification, which would be assistant attorney generals at the DOJ who wrote the so-called torture memos, and then the people who implemented it. But you wouldn't get to C, the implementation, without A and B. So only looking at C is really an inequity.
Siobhan Gorman, it appears to me that at the very least this report confirms this idea that there's a pattern here, that there's no way the CIA can claim it's a lot of rogue agents taking matters into their own hands back in 2002, right?
Well, my understanding is that what the report finds is that the guidelines were inadequate to prevent these kinds of activities that would sort of, go beyond what most people, I think, probably feel are acceptable. And so I think that what you're going to start to see are some broader generalizations about what the program did and didn't provide in terms of particularly safeguards against abuse.
Now, which is the most prosecutable? And again, the New York Times is reporting this morning that the Justice Department's Ethics Office has officially recommended reopening nearly a dozen prison abuse cases. This doesn't refer explicitly to the CIA Inspector General's report. But, if the Justice Department gets into actual prosecutions here, are they going to have to go after individual agents, or would they go after this safeguards issue, that the safeguards were ignored or were recklessly implemented by higher-ups in the CIA?
Well, the people I've talked with at CIA are very worried that the temptation would be to go toward prosecuting just the individual, whoever was in the room and directly conducted the activity, and not take into account the type of guidance and direction that they were given. So that's actually the fear. It depends. It's totally at the discretion of the prosecutor how far up the chain they actually want to go.
Art Keller, this is Femi Okay talking to you this morning. You worked in Pakistan back in 2006. Were you given some very clear guidelines as to how much you could do to suspects that you were interrogating?
As it happened, I was never in a situation to interrogate people. Most of the things that I did, because of the difficulty in operating the area, were carried out via proxy. So I would essentially have to tell a local agent who worked for me to go meet another local person because a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy sticks out a little bit in the tribal areas.
Well, but nevertheless, how confident could you be, you blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy, that your guidelines would actually be followed if your proxy did actually have an interrogation?
It never came up in my case, so I can't really. It is a problem because in the culture of Pakistan, they have a different perspective on what's allowable than we do in the U.S. in my experience. So it is a concern. All I can say is when
you're not saying that Pakistanis don't care about torture, though, right?
I'm not saying that they don't care about torture. I would say they have a laxer attitude towards it in official circles than people in the U.S. government.
I see, and they are our allies.
They are our allies.
All right, well, then let's shift gears here a little bit, and I want an answer from both you and Siobhan. I'll begin with you, Siobhan. What does this say about Leon Panetta? He's the head of the CIA. Are the screws really turned on him to shield the agency from Eric Holder and DOJ, or to open it up and basically allow a kind of a cleaning of house and putting the whole Bush era behind us?
Well, Mr. Panetta is in a really tough position, and I know a number of the people who have advised Mr. Panetta have strongly said, and these are, you know, CIA veterans, people with long ties to the agency, that he does need to take sort of a clean slate approach and kind of have a cleansing process, whereas other people have said, no, you can't, you know, vilify your own agency. You are the leader of this agency, and you need to support them. And I think that we've seen that tension actually as we've watched the administration debate whether to release certain kinds of documents. I mean, this time around, but in April, we saw them basically, you know, let it all hang out with the legal documents that they put out, and they didn't keep any of it. They kept very, very little of it under wraps. This time around, I think that with the Inspector General report, we'll see probably about half of it kept under wraps. So there may well be a number of details that the public doesn't know about, at least not in today's release. I think that in part, Panetta is trying to, you know, cast a balance by controlling some of the information. But when it comes to prosecutions, that is a Justice Department matter, and I'm sure Panetta can provide his advice, but he's not the ultimate decision-maker.
Right. Well, tough calls ahead for Leon Panetta at CIA, Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent with the Wall Street Journal, but very high stakes for Eric Holder over at the Department of Justice. Art Keller, from your perspective, who's more vulnerable here, CIA operations personnel or CIA sort of analysts and the high-level kind of policy folks who may have created some of the guidelines, the John Hughes, the sort of people who wrote the guidelines that moved us into this area?
I would certainly say the people who wrote the guidelines and the field officers who implemented them. Analysts traditionally wouldn't enter into this area.
You mean so that means both? That means it's sort of open season.
Pretty much, yeah. I'd like to point out, though, that in addition to whether a clean sweep is made or they simply look at it and implement stronger recommendations, unless something is done to affect the DOJ memo process, where the White House was able to essentially whistle up support, legal support for any policy position they wanted, whether or not it was outside the law, then this is going to happen again at some point in time on another issue.
I love the way you characterize that the White House can whistle up any sort of legal justification for anything it wants, and that's your characterization of what happened during the Bush years. All right, very quickly, thank you, Art Keller, retired CIA officer, speaking with us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Siobhan Gorman, are you clear in any sense as to whether Obama wants to go forward on prosecutions or put this all behind us? It seems to me he's pretty unclear on all this. Quickly.
Yeah, so far Obama has said that he doesn't want to look back, but at the same time, the Attorney General has been quite forthright in asserting that, you know, it's his job to uphold the laws of the United States, and that's his decision. So it's a tough balance that Mr. Obama has to strike as well.
But maybe the takeaway is Eric Holder seems likely to go it alone. Siobhan Gorman, thanks so much. Intelligence correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. We also spoke with Art Keller, retired CIA officer from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thanks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway
from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello there, this is Femi OK with John Hockenberry. John, I'm setting the scene with the Go-Go's.
Well, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, do you like
but
it?
But it is Monday. We need to like get going here, not
yeah, no,
take a break.
We're talking about having a break. Work isn't going well, okay?
Is that right?
Yep. You've hit a rough patch after landing a great new job.
Oh.
You're having a really tough time at work.
For heaven's sakes, this is news to me.
Friends that helped you get your job are starting to question your performance.
Oh, you must be talking about Barack Obama.
Absolutely. Confidence in his ability may be slipping. The president could do with a vacation. So the president is taking a vacation. He traveled to Martha's Vineyard on Sunday, and a lot of questions are now popping up as to why there, why now, and what is he going to do all week. So to help us answer this is John Fortier, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Also Larry Knutson, he's a retired AP reporter who's covered presidential vacations. Also the author of Escaping the Gilded Cage, A History of Presidential Vacations and Retreats. That book is coming out soon. And Carol McManus, owner and operator of Espresso Love Cafe on Martha's Vineyard. Carol is also the inventor of the Obama Muffin. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Let me start with you, Larry, first of all. Now, the president is just following a trend. There have been so many presidents who've headed to the vineyard. Who was the first one?
The first one to go to the vineyard was President U.S. Grant.
Right.
More than a century ago, obviously. And he went there because there was a Methodist camp meeting, which he was interested in. Other presidents have made that trip, including have been in the waters in and off Martha's Vineyard, including President Franklin Roosevelt, President John Kennedy, and, of course, Bill Clinton famously vacationed there.
Sure. Well, of course, Grant's visit wasn't a part of Sherman's march. Let's be clear about that, right?
That's entirely. It was way after the Civil War.
Let me bring in John Fortier. Morning, John. You're the research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Now, this vacation must have been planned for a little while. Can you actually say that there was any politics involved in going to the vineyard?
Well, I think in some ways the president might not be acting very politically. I think some might suggest he should go to more of a swing state. Massachusetts is a very Democratic state, not one that he's going to worry about in future elections. Bill Clinton himself, when he went to Martha's Vineyard, when his presidency hit the rocks later on, he was advised by his advisor, Dick Morris, to go somewhere else, to go out west, to go to Wyoming, which he did for a couple of years before returning to the vineyard. So I think there might be some criticism that this is an upscale vacation in a very Democratic state, not appealing to the middle. But I don't think it's a shrewd political move to go there. I think it's a very enjoyable place, and there are a lot of reasons he's going to want to go there. But it's certainly not appealing to the voters that he would not have in the next election.
It sounds like, John, it's absolutely clear that going to Ibiza is out of the question for any U.S. president.
So, Larry, you covered Bill Clinton's visits to Martha's Vineyard. Tell me, in terms of what you got to do, how much extra work was it?
Well, that's what you were there to do. The president went out in public, and you were with him. There was a camp of reporters set up at a crossroads near his vacation house. There was a press headquarters set up in the gymnasium of a local school in Edgartown. The whole thing worked. If he went out to have an ice cream cone, we went with him. If he went sailing, we were on a boat a mile or so away from his.
Do you detect any sense of a change in the presidential demeanor because they are on vacation and you're following them all of the time?
From president to president, I think presidents do what they feel like doing. Jerry Ford was an excellent skier, and that's what he did on his vacations. He was a natural athlete and was chagrined that the only shot photographers wanted of him was when he was falling down. Ronald Reagan cut riding trails in the woods on his California ranch. And he said it was a necessary escape because being in the White House gave him a bird in a gilded cage feeling. That's a feeling a lot of presidents have expressed. Harry Truman called it the big white jail.
Let me just bring in Carol McManus. Carol, you have Espresso Love. It's a, basically, it's a cafe on Martha's Vineyard. You've created a presidential muffin.
Huge institution on the vineyard.
Yes.
It's a monster institution.
But also a new Obama muffin as well. What's in that one?
Well, the Obama muffin, I decided I'd make it healthy, so it has oats and it has banana and applesauce, but also then I threw in the Hawaiian theme of pineapple, macadamia nuts, coconut, and I put in raspberries kind of for color.
And are you detecting any change of atmosphere? The president's only been there less than 24 hours so far.
Well, I know the anticipation has been unbelievable. People feel so proud that he chose the vineyard to come to vacation on. And my realtor friends have told me that once Obama decided to definitely come here, the phones rang off the hook of people who wanted to rent houses. So it's really been great for our economy.
Well, good luck with the muffin, Carol McManus. She's the owner and operator of Espresso Love Cafe on Martha's Vineyard. Larry Knutson is a retired AP reporter. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Escaping the Gilded Cage, A History of Presidential Vacations and Retreats. And also thanks to John Fortier, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. So time now to check up on today's top stories. John.
Well, in the headlines, a report on CIA interrogation techniques is due to be released later today. According to Newsweek, the report will show that interrogators staged mock executions to intimidate terror suspects. Use of power drills and guns was among the details in the report, and parts of the report will remain redacted. It's believed about half of the report is all that will be unredacted when the final comes out. The Justice Department is recommending that nearly a dozen cases of abuse against terrorism suspects be reopened. That's according to a story today by our partner, The New York Times. The recommendation could expose some CIA employees to official Justice Department prosecution.
President Obama has approved the creation of an elite interrogation team. That's according to The Washington Post, which reports that the team will interrogate key terrorism suspects, and that shifts oversight of interrogations from the CIA to the White House. In Afghanistan, if fraud complaints are found out to be true, they could alter the final result of Afghanistan's presidential election. The Electoral Complaints Commission says that it's gotten 225 complaints of fraud, including 35 allegations that could impact who the victor is.
In the continuing evolution from the notion of reality show star to being a synonym for sordid, reality show star Ryan Jenkins has been found dead in a secluded motel in Western Canada. Here's British Columbia Sergeant Duncan Pound.
The preliminary indicators all indicate that this was a suicide, but we are going to obviously be taking a very close look at the circumstances surrounding the death.
Jenkins was a suspect in the death of his ex-wife, a former model.
And also, we're watching some of the other news stories coming up this week. Those are the news stories that we're following this morning. But what about the rest of the week? We're going to be checking up on our news agenda in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done. What's going on?
Hello, everyone. Presidents may go on vacation, but the agenda doesn't stop. And here this morning, I'm John Hockenberry with Femi Okay. We've got Marcus Mabry back in the saddle to talk about the forthcoming headlines this week. And also Jonathan Marcus from our partner, the BBC, the diplomatic correspondent, joining us from London. Jonathan and Marcus, welcome back.
Good morning.
Marcus, let's begin with you. It seems to me that whatever sort of fun the president anticipates having in Martha's Vineyard on vacation this week, he seems to be on the defensive. We were just talking about this CIA report that's going to be released officially. Half of it will be redacted on Monday. That's going to talk about, or today, we'll talk about possible prosecutions of agents during the Bush era. Your newspaper is reporting that the Justice Department is likely to pursue some sort of actual prosecutions of CIA personnel. And then, of course, we have this.
There's no way I can pass a bill in the House of Representatives without a public option.
On health care, it appears that on the left and the right, the president is under some pressure to decide whether he is for or against a public option on health care. On the defensive on both of these, where is it headed?
Well, you know, first, John, you mentioned Ibiza and how, you know, no president can go there. Well, actually, my vacation was spent in Ibiza, at least part of it.
Is that true?
Yes, absolutely.
So you have no chance of being president.
I have just come back from Ibiza. I would suggest any president can, especially Barack Obama, given the challenges he's facing that you just outlined, head to Ibiza as soon as possible.
Marcus, what clubs did you go to? I'm trying to imagine you clubbing with your T-shirt off.
Well, I'm not even going to go there. Okay.
We have Femi.
In more serious matters, you know, the frustration the president is actually experiencing and the Democrats are as a whole, I think are really clear in what we heard this weekend. What we heard on Saturday, the president said in his address, was that he wanted people to basically stop making myths, myth-making. He said he was fine with having a legitimate discussion about the pros and cons of his different aspects of the health reform, but he said, you know, the lies have to stop.
Let's listen to the president. Here's the president trying to do that, and I want to assess from you whether this kind of language and this tone was reassuring.
Now, the source of a lot of these fears about government-run health care is confusion over what's called the public option. This is one idea among many to provide more competition and choice, especially in the many places around the country where just one insurer thoroughly dominates the marketplace.
When he says this is one idea among many, it seems to me he loses people. He's not being clear, and people don't know where things stand, and the ambiguity about whatever you're talking about, Senate or House version of this bill, plays against him.
Well, he's trying to be a politician still. He's still trying to walk that middle path between, as you said, the left and the right. But what we're seeing is the frustration among Democratic leaders is such that, as Nancy Pelosi said, and now as we're hearing from Senate Democratic leaders in the Senate, they're talking about what could be considered a nuclear option, a budget reconciliation process for health care, which would mean they could pass legislation with a simple majority vote rather than the 60% veto-proof margin they usually need. Republicans are saying that would be unfair, an abuse of a process that's really used just for reconciling budgets. But it is a measure of the Democratic frustration. We'll see this week how frustrated they are.
Well, Marcus Mabry, let me know if you believe that Senator Chuck Schumer is then right on this matter here.
If we don't have a bipartisan bill, we'll never be able to meet the goal of having a bill signed into law by the end of the year.
Bipartisanship with these kinds of majorities, that's an absolute necessity, says Schumer, or we get nothing this year.
You know, I don't think it's going to happen because Schumer also said over the weekend that it looked like the Max Baucus's process coming out of the Finance Committee, which was supposed to be the only bipartisan plan we're supposed to see, was looking more endangered. He also said, Schumer, that without a public option, there would be no way to reduce costs on health care. The Republicans have done a great job, and the opponents of the plan have done a great job of saying this is about those 15% of Americans who don't have health care. That's all 85% of us it works for, so you shouldn't be so crazy and so extreme as Obama. The Democrats will try to make it again about containing health care costs this week.
Right. Jonathan Marcus, in London, you know, there's a lot of concern about the outcome of the Afghanistan election, which the Obama administration has a lot of interest in. But overseas, it seems like the big story over the weekend and going forward is the fallout from the release of the Lockerbie bomber and how he was received back in Libya, and also discussions going on between Obama's cabinet on Middle East peace and Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel.
Well, indeed. I mean, you're right. The release of the alleged Lockerbie bomber, a man obviously convicted for that crime, has caused a huge interest here, not least because it throws up the very peculiar in some way constitutional arrangements, the division of responsibilities between London and Edinburgh. When the whole devolution process was entered into, I think nobody really imagined this kind of episode causing such a problem. And of course, it really does highlight that you know, devolution went forward here, and I think you could understand this well in the States, without any kind of federal structures being created. So Scotland is an independent country in terms not least of its judicial system, and there is no United Kingdom or Great Britain and Northern Ireland, you know, Supreme Court, as it were, to deal with these kinds of issues. And of course, since foreign policy is outside the remit of the government in Edinburgh, and clearly this is a decision which has huge implications for foreign policy, it's quite a difficult issue.
Best guess, Jonathan Marcus, does this catch fire this week or settle down?
I think it's likely to settle down. I think already it's degenerating into something of a political slanging match between, obviously, a Labour government in London and the Scottish National Party, who are in power in Edinburgh, a minority government there, but obviously the Labour Party's main opposition in Scotland. The main that's they battle for the working class vote in Scotland. So I think it's got a lot of domestic political overtones as well. It's obviously soured relations to an extent with Washington. Obviously, they will get over that. But it does highlight some continuing problems, I think, back home in the way we arrange our affairs.
All right, Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent in London, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor at The New York Times. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the domestic implications of GDP numbers coming out this week. The whole world will be watching those.
We'll see them by then on Thursday.
Are we shrinking less or growing more? What do you think, Marcus?
I think we're shrinking less.
Shrinking
less.
That's
a positive right now.
Thanks so much, Marcus Mabry and Jonathan Marcus. And there's your agenda. So let's look back at some of today's headlines.
Thanks, John. Several big stories about the CIA out today. A new version of a report on interrogation techniques the agency used is due to be released later today. Now, according to Newsweek, the report will show that interrogators staged mock executions to intimidate terror suspects, and parts of the report will remain redacted. Meanwhile, the Justice Department may reopen nearly a dozen cases of suspected abuse against terrorism suspects. Our partner, The New York Times, reports that it could allow some CIA employees to be prosecuted.
The Supreme Court in Honduras says ousted President Manuel Zelaya will face trial if he returns to the country. The ruling rejects a deal brokered by Costa Rica that was intended to return him to power. Zelaya was ousted in a coup in June. In China, more than 200 people are expected to go on trial this week for taking part in riots that killed nearly 200 people last month. It was the worst ethnic violence in China in decades between Han Chinese and the Uyghurs.
And those are some of today's top headlines. Coming up, the number of women arrested for drunk driving is on the rise. So why do you think that is? We talk about families every Monday, and we'll look at where mums fit into this statistic. That's coming up in 10 minutes. Good morning. I'm Femi Okeh.
And I'm John Hockenberry. So a look at the weekend sports with our friend Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway Sports contributor. A couple of things, two really big things to talk about. One that's a little bit more historical, the fate of Pete Rose. Let's listen to Pete Rose talking back in 1989, denying the allegation that has dogged him and caused him to be banned from baseball.
I did not bet on baseball, and I will continue to say that until the day I leave this world.
But then with ABC's Charlie Gibson, Rose finally admitted what many had suspected for years.
Did you bet on baseball?
Yes, I did, and that was my mistake, not coming clean a lot earlier.
Well, Pete Rose, who played for the Cincinnati Reds, was part of the Big Red Machine, was a huge monster record acquirer in baseball. And while the question of whether he bet on baseball is settled, the question of whether he should be banned from baseball is not, because he has so many records.
Pete Rose will never not be in the Hall of Fame because Pete Rose has 4,000 hits. He is the hit leader in all of baseball. But at the same time, because he lied for 14 years about whether he betted on baseball, he joins the ranks of the Black Sox and of the 1919 Chicago White Sox,
right,
of being the cheaters of baseball. And I don't think there's anyone that can ever forgive him for doing that.
But, you know, it's so interesting in these steroid times, right, to look at these numbers. It's really amazing. 4,256 career hits, right? I mean, that's huge. 3,562 games played. Most at-bats, 14,053. Carl Ripken got in the Hall of Fame for just basically showing up a few thousand times, right?
You're not going to ever get him out of the Hall of Fame. I think this is what people don't really get. He's never not going to be reflected in the Hall of Fame. He just won't be enshrined as one of the great players that people should look up to as a role model for the rest of baseball history.
So when does this change? How does this change?
There's almost zero chance for him ever to get elected into the Hall of Fame or to erase that ban.
What about... This is horrible, but what about when he dies? Do you think people will then forgive him?
This is the challenge right here. He's already passed that 15 years where the sports writers would vote him in.
Right.
Now he has to get voted in by the 65 living members of the people that are currently in the hall already. Those are the people who hold on to the legacy and the majesty and the history of the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's highly unlikely that those folks are going to vote him in.
So the commissioner can't unilaterally do this posthumously.
I think he's angered Bud Selig a little bit too much.
any pressure, any precedent for a posthumously inducted member of the Hall of Fame?
That's
a good trivia question. You work
on
that
one. Yeah.
All right. Also, look in the MLB rule book. An unassisted triple play. It happened yesterday. The Phillies playing the Mets. The Mets looked like they could possibly win the game in the bottom of the ninth. All of a sudden, kaboom! What happened?
The ball gets shot directly to second baseman Eric Barton Bruntlett, and basically
he made two errors in that inning.
That's interesting. Yeah. He did make two errors. So he catches the ball. He redeems himself. He tags
so
the guy.
So he catches the ball. That's one out.
Exactly. The guy. There was a guy on first and second. The guy runs off a second, and they were both running off. He tags the second base.
That's two outs.
And then he tags the guy who's running from first to second.
And he nails Daniel Murphy for the third out.
And he ends the game.
The last time that happened was 1927.
27.
Wow.
So it was it's rarer than a perfect game. We were just saying in the
Well, if you make two errors in the ninth inning of a game. A good way to redeem yourself is to do an unassisted triple play, wouldn't you say?
Indeed, without a doubt.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, words to live by, Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello there, Femi OK and John Hockenbury looking after you this morning. Coming up, with the number of women arrested for drunk driving on the rise, where are mums in this upturn? We'll find out in a couple of minutes. We're also talking about the Cash for Clunkers programme, which actually ends today. So we're asking you, if you don't get money, what else can the car makers and the government offer you for your junker? Maybe some free healthcare, some free travel. How about
Get it out of my driveway. Just please.
8778 my take, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, John has some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Well, there appears to be a power shift going on between the CIA and the Department of Justice as we're awaiting a new version of a 2004 CIA report on interrogation techniques. We're also learning that the president has approved a new FBI unit to interrogate key terrorism suspects. The Washington Post reports that this will shift oversight from the CIA to the White House.
There are new concerns about the war in Afghanistan. U.S. military commanders there say that they don't have enough troops to do their job. Chairman of Joint Chiefs Admiral Mike Mullen spoke to NBC.
I am very mindful and concerned about the threat that's there. The strategy really focuses on defeating Al-Qaeda and their extremist allies.
Mullen says that Afghanistan is still in danger of being overtaken again by the Taliban.
The head of the Electoral Commission in Afghanistan says 15% of the complaints his office has received are, quote, material to the election results, which means they could influence the outcome if they turn out to be true. And finally, out in the Atlantic, Bill was a hurricane, now downgraded to a tropical storm. It's moving off the coast of Newfoundland. The storm is still churning up big waves, blamed for two deaths on the East Coast. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So it's Monday on The Takeaway, and that means we're talking about family. Last week, a government report caught our attention. Now, it showed that from 1997 to 2007, the number of women arrested for drinking and driving rose by 30%. And that report was released right in the middle of a very lively round of discussions in the blogosphere about mums who drink. So joining us for more on changing perceptions about mums and alcohol is The Takeaway's own family contributor, Lisa Belkin. She writes for the New York Times parenting blog, Motherload. Also joining us today, another parenting blogger, Tara Trower. She is features editor of the Austin American Statesman, and she also writes for the Statesman's Mama Drama blog. She joins us from KUT in Austin, Texas, where you can hear us every morning. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Now, you've both written recently about these issues. We know that more women are drinking and driving and being found doing that. Now, how does that play into parenthood, Lisa? Are we looking at more mums drinking and driving?
I don't know from those statistics whether or not more mothers are drinking and driving. We know more women are being arrested for drinking and driving. We also know that in the past few weeks, we are talking an awful lot more about mothers drinking and driving because of what happened here right near where I am now, near the Taconic Parkway in New York, where a mother drove the wrong way and eight people died. And it has become a flashpoint. It's become sort of an iconic moment for discussion of what kind of mother does this. And it's interesting how much more heated we've gotten because a mother did this.
Let's remind people of the details of that Taconic Parkway story. I drive that road all the time, and believe me, my whole family lit up. We have a minivan. We have four kids. Believe me, they were on the phone when they heard that story. But a woman who was driving the wrong way on the Taconic Parkway for quite a while eventually had a head-on collision with the three people in an SUV. They died. The people in her car died. So 5 + 3 = 8. She killed one of her children and three nieces. And it subsequently was discovered that she was hugely drunk, had doubled the blood alcohol level that was the legal limit.
No, and it's a horrifying, it's a haunting story. And I wrote about it on the blog, and just the floodgates opened. And personally, I don't think I have been in a conversation with friends since it happened where this hasn't come up. It's just something that has struck a nerve. And there is something about the image of a mother strapping these kids into a car seat and rolling down the highway drinking vodka. Now, some of the details still aren't clear, and some of them make no sense whatsoever. But it's something that just gets us right in the gut.
Tara Trower, features editor at the Austin American Statesman. You also write your own Mama Drama blog. What kind of reaction did you get from your readers to this particular story?
We got a lot of reaction. I think, although we're not as close geographically to the Schiller situation, it's something that people are talking about. You know, people have this idea of what mothers are supposed to do and how we make decisions and that sort of thing, and whether or not you should be drinking in front of them, whether or not you should be, obviously most people believe that drinking and driving is incorrect, but it has a lot of people talking about what is appropriate and what you should be doing as a mom.
Tara and Lisa, I want you to listen to this little clip. It's Dr. Jennifer Ashton. She's the medical correspondent for CBS. And there's been some speculation as to why mums are drinking and driving. And this is Dr. Ashton's idea.
It's the social phenomenon brought about largely by shows and movies like Sex and the City, whereby women are drinking more and more. It's glamorized. The drink, the cosmopolitan, has had a huge comeback, and we're starting to see the medical and health consequences of it.
Tara, do you buy that?
No. I think that when you look at the changing demographics of when women are becoming mothers, you've got sort of this life before and you've got this life after. I don't think that Sex and the City or these other TV shows have a whole lot to do with it, but just because you give birth doesn't change the fact that you might find a glass of wine pleasurable or going out with your friend, having a beer once in a while also. So I think that might be a stretch to blame it on the media.
But Tara, isn't there, I mean, what we're trying to get at here is there something in play? Is there something changing here? I mean, we have this idea that mothers would never risk kids in a situation like this horrible accident in New York, that maybe guys are more likely to stretch things. Dads are more likely to, well, I can, you know, just go a little faster. I can maybe pass in the passing lane, maybe. And that moms don't do this kind of thing. What's going on here, do you think?
I think it's a double standard. I mean, when you get to the case where, as I understand the case in New York, you know, 10 shots of vodka pretty much before noon, something else has checked out here. Whether or not it be illness or whatever, those things, if you've ever dealt with anyone who's an addict, sort of preempt any rational decisions you might make about parenthood and putting your kids in the car.
Lisa, tell us a little bit about Stephanie Wilder Taylor. She was a very popular blogger who used to write about drinking and being a mom, and then something happened to her. But fill our listeners in on her story.
Well, that is what's different, I think, out there. I don't think it's Sex and the City, frankly. I think it's the blogosphere and mothers sort of sharing as if they were sitting around having a drink together. And a remarkable number, a striking amount of the conversation on blogs is, you know, drunk mommy talk. Stephanie Wilder Taylor wrote several books where martinis and cosmopolitans and lampshades on the head were part of her thing. And she talked about, you know, Mommy Needs a Martini, I believe is the name of her blog. And she one day realized that she was making a living off the fact that she was drinking too much and was rather horrified, actually, and wrote about one day, just posted on her blog, that she was going to stop, that there was simply too much, that she had a problem. And it caught a lot of attention because she's not the only one. She's one of the more visible ones, but she's not the only one who, when her friends come over, instead of having coffee, they have a martini. They have a glass of wine. They finish a bottle of wine. And I think that's where women are drinking differently.
Making a living off of drinking too much. That's like Dean Martin. He did that for his entire career.
He didn't. It didn't end well for him either, although he made more money at it than Stephanie Wilder Taylor.
Tara, you wrote about Stephanie Wilder Taylor as well. Was the tone of the reaction you were getting on your blogs, was it humorous or was it serious?
It was serious. Many readers supported her decision, feeling like, that she had come to the right one, recognizing that not just during the play dates, but in the evenings, she was drinking 2-3 drinks at night just to sort of get her head around motherhood. And so it was a serious conversation. There were some people, your mother, you shouldn't be doing that. You're an awful person. But I think that the fact that she made the responsible decision once she realized that this was getting in the way of her being a good mother.
Thank you very much. Tara Trower, features editor of the Austin American Statesman and a writer of the Statesman's Mama Drama blog. And thank you also to Lisa Belkin from our partner, The New York Times. She writes for the Motherlode blog for the NewYorkTimes.com.
Well, you might say the takeaway there is a combination of yearning for empowerment and release from the tensions of motherhood leads some women to drinking.
Absolutely.
So getting drunk driving moms off the road is one thing, but the Cash for Clunkers program is ending today. So the question is, if you don't get money, what else can car makers and the government offer you either for your junker or to get you to buy a car? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us a suggestion at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I am Femi Okay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. So trying to boil down the healthcare debate, there's a tendency for your John Q. Public to take extreme measures.
My son is very sick, and he needs some help.
We all know we need insurance reform.
Put the gun down, John. It's hard to be a man these days. Hard to know what the right thing is.
Never go to a federal government program.
You're not hearing me. My son is sick. When people are sick, they deserve a little help.
To take care of 15 million people, if we do that, we'll bankrupt the country.
I am not going to bury my son.
Buried in the healthcare debate is a potent mix of life and death and taxes. The Obama administration hopes to get the attention of doctors without taking hostages.
Put the gun down, John.
Okay, it's down. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, August 24th, I'm John Q. Public Radio Hockenberry with the one and only Femi Okay all week long. Morning, Fem.
Good morning. Is that a gun in the studio or are you just pleased that I'm co-hosting?
Oh, my God. This hour on the show, clunkers out of cash tonight. We may be off the air in a minute. The CIA has some more to answer for in a new report. We'll talk about it with one of the agency's former directors, James Woolsey, and then Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, journalists from The New York Times, talk about their global mission to empower women everywhere in the world. But first, we have a doctor in the house, fortunately, Dr. Kevin Poe, primary care physician in Nashua, New Hampshire. So, doctor, do you see all of this healthcare debate bringing better communication between doctors and patients?
Well, I think that with healthcare reform dominating the news cycle, patients are going to have questions. There's a lot of misconceptions and misperceptions out there. So the answer is yes. I've had the opportunity in almost every visit to answer some questions that patients have on health reform. And in some cases, it's really engaged issues that I don't normally talk about. Patients are worrying about cost and coverage. And I think that it is opening up a dialogue.
Well, that's a positive thing, Dr. Poe, primary care physician on the front lines of the healthcare debate. We're going to talk with you and some other doctors in a round table just a little later on in the program. But first, everything you need to know this morning, Femi.
Thanks, John. In the headlines, lots of news this morning on the CIA. First up, previously withheld details on CIA prisoner abuses are scheduled to come out today. They'll be revealed in a new version of a 2004 report. Meanwhile, another Justice Department report recommends that nearly a dozen prisoner abuse cases be reopened. That's from our partner, The New York Times, and that could expose some CIA employees to prosecution. There's also news that the president has approved a new FBI unit to interrogate key terrorism suspects. According to the Washington Post, that will shift oversight from the CIA to the White House.
You know, that suggests there's a real power struggle going on between the CIA and the Justice Department right now. New concerns about the war in Afghanistan. U.S. military commanders say they don't have enough troops to do their jobs. That's according to Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who told CNN that the Taliban has gotten better and more sophisticated. Markets closed up more than 1% on Friday. The Dow opens this hour at 9506, the S&P at 1026. The NASDAQ begins at 2021, and futures trading suggests a positive opening when Wall Street gets underway in about a half hour from now. So Cash for Clunkers ends today, but what'll get you out of your driveway and down to the dealer to buy a new car? Call us 877-8MYTAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Hello there, I'm Femi Oke, in All Week with John Hockenberry. This week, The Takeaway is getting together some mini roundtable discussions. So we'll be looking at how different groups of Americans will be affected by healthcare reform. So later this week, we'll be checking in with young people, the chronically ill, small business owners, and Americans living abroad.
I mean, these are really conversations that are happening all over the United States, table. I mean, the town meetings really are one thing, but the actual conversations in people's homes are something else.
That real people are having. And today we're gathered together, our little medical team. So Dr. Kevin Poe, you heard him a little bit earlier, is a primary care physician in Nashua, New Hampshire. He also blogs at kevinmd.com. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
Dr. Charles Prestigiacomo is Associate Professor of Neurosurgery at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. Let me practice my bedside morning. How are you doing this morning, Doctor?
Good morning. Doing very well, and thank you for the invitation this morning.
You're very welcome. And Dr. Thais Gaines-Reed is currently in her third year as an emergency care resident at Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut. Good morning to you, Dr. Thais.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome all. First of all, medical team, I want to play you a little scene from John Q, the movie.
Okay, all right. All right. Listen, all right, wait, listen, everybody. All right, hey, the hospital's under new management now. Yeah. Yeah, from now on, free health care for everybody. How's that?
Oh, righteous, man.
Dr. Thais Gaines-Reed, free healthcare for everybody from the ER of John Q, the movie. Now, Denzel Washington was taking hostages there. I'm hoping that we don't have to go this far for our healthcare debate. But you've read both bills. What do you like in them?
From the perspective of an emergency medicine physician, what I like is the fact that it's allowing all people in America to basically have coverage. I mean, we are on the front lines seeing patients who are coming to us instead of their primary care physicians because they can't get in to see them because they don't have insurance, or actually the consequences of not being able to afford their medications and the catastrophes that happen because of that. So I'm most excited about the fact that everyone is going to get covered by this.
But Dr. Thais, how would that change you being a primary care physician? What in the bill says that there will be fewer people going to emergency rooms to see someone like you and more people going to visit Dr. Kevin Poe, who is an actual primary care physician, before it ends up as an emergency?
Very good question. I mean, I don't think that there's anything that necessarily says, okay, less people or fewer people are going to go to the emergency department. However, the fact that the bills are stressing the need and the importance of preventive care, and the fact that physicians will potentially get reimbursed more for doing preventive care, hopefully preventing people from getting to the extremes of disease the way that we see them, it's nothing concrete, but it's hopeful that maybe there will be more of a shift toward primary care and preventive care before getting to the point at which I see them.
Let me just bring back in Dr. Poe. You're a primary care physician. Do patients understand the reform options accurately? Do you understand them even?
Well, there are a lot of competing proposals out there, and I think there's a lot of communication issues. And I think that fact stems from there is no final bill yet. There are 4 to 5 competing bills, and a lot of the details are changing on a daily basis. So I think there's a lot of confusion, and I have to clear up a lot of misperceptions and clear up some factual inconsistencies that patients bring up. And until that there's a final bill, and I don't anticipate that happening for another 1 to 2 months, I think that confusion is going to continue.
So, Dr. Poe, you're in Nashua, New Hampshire. What difference will reform actually make to your patients, in your opinion?
Well, I think that, as Dr. Taiz mentioned earlier, there is sentiment that everyone needs to be covered, and I think that that's very, very important. But I think that there's a lot of fear among the people who are insured as to how it's going to affect them. Is it going to affect the doctors I'm able to see? Is it going to affect the tests that I'm able to get or not? But then on the flip side, I think there's a lot of fear of the people who are without insurance or are soon to be unemployed and without insurance, and there's a fear of the status quo. So I think on both sides, there's a lot of apprehension about upcoming reform.
So two voices from the front lines, Kevin Poe, primary care physician, and Dr. Thais Gaines-Reed, an emergency room resident. Dr. Charles Prestigiacomo, associate professor of neurosurgery, you are the voice of the specialist in this. Where do you stand on the healthcare debate? And does this talk about preventive care and greater reimbursement and full coverage make you a little nervous?
Hi. No, I don't think that it makes me nervous. I think the biggest point that was already brought up by Dr. Poe and Dr. Gaines-Reed is simply that there's still a lot to learn from this bill. And I think that the biggest issue that faces specialists is that as much as there is a shortage in primary care and primary care surgery, there is some shortage in a lot of the specialties. And this bill really hasn't addressed those issues as well.
So when you say, so does that mean that that there are constituencies within healthcare, within the medical world, where specialists are sort of at odds with primary care physicians and ER physicians?
I don't think that they're at odds. I think that everybody, every physician feels and believes that the healthcare system as it presently stands is not at its best. There's still 50 million uninsured in this country, and everybody wants and believes that all should be insured. The question that remains is how to best do this, and I don't think that the details of this bill have been adequately studied to make sure that, number one, you cover all of the 50 million uninsured, which this bill, I believe, fails to do, nor does it address the underinsured. And it doesn't really address what's going to happen 2 years from now when these rates are set and it's unclear what's going to happen from there.
Let me go around our virtual round table with all of our medical team and ask you what you think is most broken about our healthcare system. Dr. Gaines-Reed, you start.
There's so much that's broken. I guess that the biggest thing, like I said, from my perspective, is how many people are not covered and how many people have coverage, and it just does not cover all that they need. I mean, I know this from both sides, both as a patient side and as a clinician prior to becoming a resident. I was under, like the individual self-employed insurance and was underinsured, and at one point had to come out of pocket almost $12,000 just related to the birth of my son. So I know from both sides, how it can break you. And, you know, financially, we're talking about the working class. We're talking about people who do have a job and, you know, took whatever plan was offered to them or found individual health insurance because they're self-employed, and they're still, you know, having to fork out thousands and thousands of dollars to, you know, have health care, like to receive health care. So I think that that's the biggest thing, having an option that is affordable for everyone, not just people who are below the poverty level and not just people who are elderly, but people who are our workforce in this country. I think that's probably the biggest thing that I think is broken about the system.
Dr. Kevin Poe, primary care physician in Nashua, New Hampshire, what's most broken about the healthcare system?
I think it's a failure to address the primary care shortage. I think universal coverage is great, and I definitely believe that every American should have access to affordable health care. But if you don't have enough doctors to see them, what's the point of having health insurance? And I think a great example of this is what you see in Massachusetts, which is what a lot of the bills in Congress are trying to emulate. In Massachusetts, 97% of its residents have health insurance, which is a great number. But if you look at the waiting times for them to see a primary care doctor, it ranges from 30 to 60 days. And when you have patients waiting that long for routine issues, they're going to invariably find themselves in Dr. Gaines Reed's emergency rooms, where costs of treating patients can be up to 10 times higher than in an office visit. So costs are not going to be controlled if you don't have enough primary care doctors to see these patients. And if you can't fiscally sustain universal coverage, which Massachusetts is having trouble with, they're cutting health benefits to 30,000 legal immigrants and cutting funding to inner-city hospitals that serve the poor, they're going to find that universal coverage is going to be very difficult to sustain. So I think universal coverage is of paramount importance, but the shortage of primary care doctors and the need to address that is of equal importance.
Dr. Presti Giacomo, you are going to have the last word in the last few seconds. What is your priority to fix in our healthcare system?
I think the biggest problem and the reason why, in part, the costs are so high for healthcare is liability. And so I think that liability protection and liability reform are very, very important in our healthcare system. And this bill, unfortunately, fails to address that as one of the main points for the future of healthcare in the United States.
Thank you very much to our medical team. You've been listening to Three Doctors. Dr. Kevin Poe is a primary care physician in New Hampshire. Charles Presti Giacomo is a neurosurgeon and associated professor at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. And Thais Gaines Reed is currently in her third year as an emergency care resident at Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut. Thank you, team, for joining us. And remember, we'll be doing our roundtables all this week on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
You big dummy.
That's right, you big dummy. If you haven't taken advantage of the Cash for Clunkers program, the program ends tonight at about 8 p.m., $3 billion. Got people back in the auto dealerships and buying cars during the recession, but poof, that money is up in smoke. How are dealers and big automakers going to get people to come in and buy cars without a $4,500 incentive like this? It seems to me we've gotten an interesting sort of snapshot of the auto industry and of the demand out there, pent up or otherwise. Bill Undereiner joins us now, owner of Undereiner Motors, an auto dealership in Billings, Montana, sells Buicks, Volvos, Hondas, and Hyundais. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
And Mark Leneve, Vice President of Sales at General Motors, joins us from Detroit. Mr. Leneve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
For both of you, the question right now, it seems to me, is what has Cash for Clunkers proven? That there's a zillion people out there who are dying to buy a new car, and if they just had a program like this, they would do it? Or does this represent a group of people who wouldn't ordinarily be the audience for new cars, whether they're General Motors or Hyundai? Mark Leneve, I'll begin with you.
Well, I think it brought a lot of people into the market that normally wouldn't have been in. If you're sitting on one of these vehicles, the car had to be X number of years old, meet the eligibility requirements in terms of, fuel consumption, which means it probably wasn't very good on fuel consumption. And a twist to it was if the program was worth either $3,500 or $4,500, depending on the vehicle, that means that for it to be economically viable at the point of making the deal, that the wholesale value of that vehicle as a trade had to be less than that. So these kinds of cars typically are only going to account for about 5% of the transactions that are going on. And I would say during the Cash for Clunkers program, they probably accounted for closer to 35 or 40%. Uh-huh. So get a tremendous amount of lift off of bringing those customers into the market that otherwise wouldn't have been in.
So, Bill Undereiner, is that what you're seeing as a dealer out there in Billings, Montana, that as Mark Leneve just said, this is basically using a very small traditional market to really lift the entire sales of cars?
Well, I think it is. What I've seen, the customers coming through my door, are people that probably wouldn't have been in the market unless there was this government program. The trades that we have seen have been cars that probably are worth $100 to $500, and they're vehicles that people probably had as their third vehicle, and they find that there's an opportunity to get $4,500 or $3,500 for those cars, and it's a great opportunity for them to have the sale or buy a car that probably they wouldn't.
Huh. So, Mark Lenave, this doesn't go much beyond this program. This isn't a boost that's sustainable in any sense.
It's a boost that, from a standpoint of the lift that we've seen with increased activity of these kinds of vehicles being traded in, we agree that that's going to fall off. However, compared to some other previous big incentive programs, such as when we ran employee discount a few years ago, some of the big zero for 72, and those kind of programs, you'd pull business ahead, and you'd really experience a very severe drop-off when the program ended because you'd have moved business up 1, 2, 3, 4 months. We're not going to see that with this program. This isn't business that was moved ahead. This was a pure lift to the overall vehicle market. And we sold a lot of vehicles off the traffic that customers would come in and actually the vehicle wasn't clunker eligible. But, however, the dealer would say, hey, the wholesale value of this car is $4,000 or $5,000. We can make you a deal on this particular product. And we did a lot of business, we believe, off associated traffic that wasn't directly a clunker deal, but was generated by interest in the clunker program.
Well, must have just been a thrill to see people in the dealerships for the first time in a while. Bill Underreiner, you said two things that I really want to follow up on. First of all, you said people were bringing in cars that were real dogs. Now, were the repair shops working late hours to get some of these things actually drivable so that they could be eligible for the program?
Probably a few of them, but not a lot of them. I mean, they were cars that probably people had around that would run because the program stated you had to have a car that ran when it come in the dealership, and we ran each one of them around the block to make sure that was true. A couple of them came in on trailers because they didn't feel that they could get them to the dealership and have them run. But most of them were cars that were just sitting around and were drivable.
Well, finally, Bill and Mark, and let me start with you, Bill. If you were going to design a program that would continue the incentive of Clash for Clunkers, what would it be, even though this doesn't seem like it's sustainable? Bill?
Well, I think that you're going to have people coming in, at least I hope in the next few weeks, that missed out on the clunker program, and that we have the incentives available that we could come close to what it would have been if they would have the clunker. That's I think going forward, I think we're still going to see people, and I agree with Mark, this wasn't pulling people forward. This was people that didn't have that had no reason to buy a car unless they had this type of program.
Right.
So I think we're going to see people coming in that we can offer maybe close to what the clunker deal was.
Mark Lenave, I'll give you the last word here. Why don't you get on the horn and call up your owners there in Washington and design a program that would continue this so that it doesn't just become a flash in the pan?
Well, I think the program's been wildly successful. I have been talking to the Automotive Task Force as well as other folks that we're doing business with in Washington. And obviously, I think of all the stimulus programs that are out there, this one has received a lot of attention. It shows if you put dollars in the hands of the consumer in terms of stimulus, it tends to really work, and hopefully it provides somewhat of a template for future stimulus programs. And yeah, I mean, in the byproduct of all this, obviously, provide a lift to the industry, which I think a piece of it will be sustainable. And it took a lot of old vehicles with a very high level of emissions off the road and replaced them with high mileage, low emission vehicles, which I think was the intent from the beginning. So it looks like a win-win, and hopefully they'll follow up with similar types of programs for not just for our industry, but across several industries keep the economic activity improving.
And at $3 billion, it's kind of a bargain compared to bailing out banks, wouldn't you say? Mark Lenave, Vice President of Sales at General Motors, joining us from Detroit. Bill Underreiner, owner of Underreiner Motors there in Billings, Montana. And quickly, if you aren't getting money for your junker, what else can car makers and the government offer you to get you to go down to the dealer? Free health care for a year, a bus pass, a new bicycle? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now a quick look at the top headlines.
Thanks, John. The CIA is a major topic this morning. New details on the agency's interrogation techniques are set to come out today, and they'll be revealed in a new version of a 2004 report. Meanwhile, our partner, the New York Times, reports that the Justice Department may reopen nearly a dozen cases of suspected abuse against terrorism suspects, and that could cause some CIA employees to be prosecuted.
In international news, Honduras' Supreme Court says ousted President Manuel Zelaya will face trial if he returns to the country. We're going to talk with James Woolsey about the CIA developments this morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Femi Okay here with John Hockenberry this morning. Lots of news this morning, John, from the CIA. Just breaking from our partners, The New York Times. The Justice Department's Ethics Office has recommended reopening almost a dozen prison abuse cases. The recommendation reverses the Bush administration's earlier policy. Also news that the president has approved a new FBI unit to interrogate key terrorism suspects. Now, according to the Washington Post, that will shift oversight from the CIA to the White House. And today, the Justice Department is expected to release a never-seen-before 2004 CIA Inspector General report that is said to detail harsh interrogation techniques in CIA prisons.
It's never been made public. The report's actually been kicking around for years.
But it's the first time we'll be able to get
some kind
of view of
it. And it's expected to be pretty explosive.
So now for a look at what kind of ripples that report may cause, we are joined by James Woolsey. From 1993 to 95, he was director of the CIA under President Clinton. Today, he's a venture partner with Vantage Point, where he specializes in clean energy. He's also the Annenberg Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, I have to dig into your experience with the CIA. How do you think the CIA got into the situation it is in today?
I don't know. I stepped down as director nearly 15 years ago in January of 95, and those were simpler times. We didn't have prisoners. We took over just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and our problems generally were trying to help the U.S. government figure out where and whether it needed to intervene on humanitarian grounds, Rwanda, Somalia, Bosnia, et cetera. So I'm no more really than an informed newspaper reader on these issues, although I do have a high regard for John Helgerson, the CIA Inspector General in 2004. I haven't seen the report, of course, but John worked for me and is a very able man and a very fair-minded individual.
But you wouldn't say that living in complicated post-9/11 times is in any sense a rationale for staging mock executions with power drills and things.
I know what they did, and I'm not going to answer hypotheticals about what they did or didn't do based on reports that I haven't read. You need to have somebody who is more eager to wade into areas he doesn't have the facts on than me in order to get answers to those kinds of questions.
There is a connection, though, between yourself and Leon Panetta about being...
Leon is an excellent individual. I've known him for many years since he was a congressman and back into the 80s, and I think he's handling these issues quite well. I think these issues are issues that when they come up, they ought to be dealt with by the director and by the oversight committees of the House and Senate. Those have able staffs. They have members who are versed in intelligence issues, and that seems to me to be the right forum for addressing these questions.
So you and Panetta both came to the CIA as outsiders. Now, how would you recommend that he went forward? Do you try to win over the loyalty of the building?
Leon is not an outsider of the government by any means. He had a very distinguished career in the Congress. He was chief of staff at the White House. He ran OMB. He has a lot of governmental experience, and most people who have been directors of Central Intelligence and then in the later structure where you had a director of National Intelligence and a director of the CIA being separate have come from outside the CIA. There's only been a handful of people who have come to those jobs from inside the CIA. Some have come from inside the intelligence community within the military. Leon doesn't need advice from me on how to work with his former colleagues on the Hill and with the administration. He has excellent instincts on those questions.
So, James Woolsey, I'm motivated to ask maybe a more personal question. You know, General Wesley Clark is also involved in green energy as a venture partner with another firm. How do you get from national security matters and global security matters to a focus on green energy? Is that because it's an opportune time to do that, or is it a core interest?
Well, I've been interested in the national security implications of energy since sitting in a gasoline line in October of 1973 in the middle of the Yom Kippur War. I was general counsel of the Senate Armed Services Committee. I was late to run a hearing because the Saudis had cut off our oil because we were trying to keep Israel from being overrun by its neighbors. And I got rather bothered by that situation in 1973, and I've been bothered for over 35 years. I've been working on these issues, both on the environmental and the energy side, since at least the early 80s, writing about them, speaking about them, organizing think tank discussion groups, etc., working with the Rocky Mountain Institute, both on oil, which is a combined strategic and climate problem for us, and oil dominates the transportation market. It has a 97% monopoly over transportation.
No, I understand that, but do you security guys have real clout in this debate? We've heard the Al Gore argument about climate change and saving the polar bears and that sort of thing. As a national security argument, is this something that really moves the market?
Other people than me are going to have to decide that. I know what I think is important, which is that we move as rapidly away from oil as we possibly can. Because of its monopoly over transportation, because of its tie to regimes that damage in many ways our national security in the Middle East and elsewhere, because of its contribution to carbon in the environment, because of its pollution. We need to move toward, I think, plug-in hybrids using electricity. We need to move toward biofuels, and we need to move toward fuel efficiency, all three. If you do all three of those, then within 15 or 20 years, I think you could make a very substantial dent in oil's monopoly over transportation. You could break it, and that's what we need to do.
James Woolsey, thank you for being so versatile and flexible, talking about the CIA stories that are topping our news this morning. James Woolsey was a Central Intelligence Director under the Clinton administration from 1993 to 1995. Today, he's a venture partner with Vantage Point, where he specializes in clean energy. He's also an Annenberg Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institute. Time to check up on the news headlines with John.
Well, as we've been discussing previously, withheld details on CIA prisoner abuses are scheduled to come out today. They'll be revealed in a new version of a 2004 report. There's also news that the president has approved a new FBI unit to interrogate key terrorism suspects. According to the Washington Post, that would shift oversight on issues of sensitive interrogations from the CIA to the White House. Overseas American military commanders in Afghanistan say they don't have enough troops to combat the Taliban. Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, spoke about the situation on Meet the Press yesterday.
Afghanistan is very vulnerable in terms of Taliban and extremists taking over again, and I don't think that threat's going to go away.
Admiral Mullen says an assessment of the strategy in Afghanistan is expected in the next few weeks, not expected to call for more troops. Meanwhile, the head of the Electoral Complaints Commission in Afghanistan says 15% of the allegations in the office they've received are, quote, material to the election results, which means they could influence the outcome. That's a look at some of our top stories this morning. So, Femi, the
yes.
biggest moral issue the world faces today?
Right. I would say poverty and not enough food.
Well, they all relate to one that we'll talk about with Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wudun of The New York Times in just 10 minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Femi Ok.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us is White House correspondent for The New York Times, Peter Baker, to comment on something that Admiral Mike Mullen said on the CNN State of the Union program yesterday.
Well, I think it is serious, and it is deteriorating, and I've said that over the last couple of years, that the Taliban insurgency has gotten better, more sophisticated, their tactics, just in my recent visits out there.
As he was speaking, Peter Baker, a piece in the New York Times Sunday edition really described in a multi-layered way how serious the Afghan war is becoming for the Obama administration. To have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs talk about it in those terms seems to confirm exactly what you were trying to get at yesterday.
It certainly has a certain echoes for this president of other presidents in the past. One of the things what we wrote about was how President Obama has been compared to President Lincoln or President FDR, but what if, in fact, the model he should worry about is actually LBJ in Vietnam? it's not a new thought, but it's something that seems to be coming up more and more these days with the sort of dire comments that you heard from Mullen yesterday, and more you're hearing, I think, voices in Washington and around the country questioning the reasons for staying in Afghanistan, whether this war can be won. Remember, this had been, of course, the, quote, good war, the justified war, the war of necessity that people had always sort of believed in, even if they didn't believe in Iraq. But that seems to be changing now, and that's a real concern, I think, for the Obama White House.
But does the war of necessity argument hold 8 years after 9/11 in Afghanistan?
Some people don't think as much as it used to. You know, Richard Haass, for instance, used to be a top official in the Bush administration. He turned into a critic, and he wrote a book recently about this very concept of war of necessity. And his argument is that Afghanistan might have been a war of necessity in the past, but right now it's not anymore. It's a war of choice, that there are alternatives, increased use of these drones to attack terrorists, building up the Afghan security force and so forth. And so he took on the president. The president last week at the VFW in Phoenix said this is not a war of choice, it's a war of necessity. Mm. Richard Haass says, no, it's the exact opposite. Mm.
Well, let's talk about the LBJ analogy that you raised in a cautionary way a moment ago. I mean, if Obama is to be compared to LBJ, perhaps what we should look for is the extent to which he simply trusts the intellectual prowess of the people around him, as LBJ did with Robert McNamara, and really got sent into obscurity regarding Vietnam. Is there any sense that Obama is, say, trusting Bob Gates too much here, trusting the people at the Pentagon too much?
Well, I think it's early to say that sort of thing. I think that obviously Obama is a new president. He doesn't have his feet on the ground yet, or when it comes to, his comfort level with making military decisions. That's something that you can only learn after being in that office for a while.
Well, he has less than half of his appointees actually in office, according to your piece this morning.
That's right. Exactly. He doesn't even yet have a Secretary of the Army. He doesn't even have an Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness, which is a pretty important job right now.
Yeah.
So, he's still relatively new at this. I don't think Gates is McNamara. I think that the situation that is presented to Gates and Obama is one that is dangerous and haunting for any president. Nobody wants to be LBJ again.
Right.
Look at what LBJ did. LBJ was somebody who wanted to transform American society home, right? The great society.
Well, he did that, but Vietnam was the stumbling block. We'll leave it there. We've already been 8 years in Afghanistan. Where will we go from here? Peter Baker, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Femi OK. Coming up, The New York Times' Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn join us to discuss lessons from two lifetimes of world traveling as journalists. We'll talk with them in just a few minutes. We're also talking about the Cash for Clunkers program all day because the program ends tonight at 8 Eastern. Did you procrastinate, huh?
This is Anita from Detroit, and I'm one of these last-minute people trying to take advantage of the Cash for Clunkers. Why? Because my car died Saturday night.
Anita, good luck. Good luck, anyway. What'll get you to take advantage of Cash for Clunkers in the waning hours of the program? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here are some of the news stories we're following this morning from someone who actually can pronounce
Cash for Clunkers.
Yeah.
Cash for Clunkers.
Yeah.
Cash
there
for Clunkers.
Go.
This
nice.
Morning,
nice.
We'll be talking about the CIA. A lot, actually. A lot of news coming up. Previously, withheld details on CIA prisoner abuses are scheduled to come out today. They're part of a new version of a 2004 report. Now, according to Newsweek, it reveals that CIA interrogators used mock executions and a power drill to intimidate prisoners. Now, this news comes as the Justice Department is recommending nearly a dozen prisoner abuse cases be reopened. And that news comes from our partner, The New York Times. And that could expose some CIA employees to prosecution, even after the president has said that he would rather move forward than get bogged down in the issue. There's also news that President Obama has approved the creation of a new FBI unit that would interrogate key terrorism suspects, and that would shift oversight of detainee interviews from the CIA to the White House. The prime suspect in the murder of swimsuit model has been found dead, who has been found dead in a secluded motel in Western Canada. Duncan Pound is with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who's investigating Ryan Jenkinson's death.
The preliminary indicators all indicate that this was a suicide, but we are going to obviously be taking a very close look at the circumstances surrounding the death.
Jenkins is a former reality show contestant and was a suspect in the death of his ex-wife. And NASA has given the green light for the Space Shuttle Discovery to lift off tomorrow after replacing a power controller. Shuttle weather officer Katie Winters says that the only obstacle now could be conditions during fueling this afternoon.
Overall, the weather is looking good for launch. We just got to get there. And so the tanking weather is going to be what we're going to be watching very closely.
The Discovery will be taking Stephen Colbert up with it. Well, not exactly Stephen Colbert. His name goes on a running machine. NASA had a competition to run a naming competition for a chamber, and the top name was Stephen Colbert. And they said, we're not naming a chamber after you, but we will name a piece of exercise equipment.
What'll it be next? How will he top that? Yes.
This one's pretty good. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
So what do you think is the biggest moral problem that we face in the world today? Racial, religious hatred? Poverty? Is it the
hunger,
wars
world
around
hunger,
the world?
Yeah. Not enough resources to go around.
Well, joining us in the studio are two people who have given a lot of thought to the big moral challenges facing people around the world, and a set of themes have emerged in their travels. Mm. Nick Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times, and his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, is a former correspondent for the paper. They're also the authors of the new book, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women. Worldwide. They have an article in this Sunday's New York Times magazine on the issue of the moral and political plight of women around the world. And that seems to be, from your view, on the nexus of political instability and economic instability, that women are there and the status of women is there in each one of those issues. It's a very, very compelling argument. How did this begin to occur to you, Nick?
This was something that grew on us really from the time when we were correspondents in China in the late 1980s. And it seemed, first of all, to us that this is really the premier moral imperative of our times, that there are tens of millions of women and girls who go missing because they are discriminated against to death. And it's hard to see any kind of moral challenge that is equivalent. And secondarily, just in our travels, it seemed to us that those countries that were more effective in fighting poverty and creating stability were those that actually educated and empowered women, and that those that didn't were those that were most prone to instability. And that gave us a real interest in addressing this.
Political equality for women as a marker for the sign of sort of advancement as a civilized nation, that's a controversial argument to make even today, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. But, you know, beyond just political equality, what we are talking about is just basic equal human rights. If you don't educate and empower women, you just can't begin to tackle poverty and extremism, and we can't advance U.S. interests throughout the world. It's kind of strange that we can put a man on the moon, but we can't treat women as human beings.
And we haven't even put a woman on the moon yet either, so we should note that. Well, how do countries deal with these issues in your travels, as you've observed it? I mean, in Darfur, in China, in South Asia, how do these nations in different ways grapple with the issue of either suppressing women or trying to bring equality and human rights to women without creating political instability in the country?
Well, of course, there are varying degrees. In many cases, women are just absolutely neglected, so that women die early, needlessly, in childbirth because there's no attention to care for them. In a place like China, in contrast, a century ago, it used to bind the feet of women. Now, partly because it allowed girls to get educated and it allowed girls to go into the workforce, which is very important. Look at their economy right now. Women helped jumpstart the entire economic juggernaut of China because they were allowed to work in factories.
How does economic empowerment of women have a dimension on reducing abuse. You tell a story of a woman in Pakistan who received a micro loan that had all kinds of implications.
Right, and we've seen this over and over. But I mean, that woman's story, I think, is fairly representative. Her name is Saima. I met her in outside the city of Lahore in a slum. She was very poor family. She, unfortunately for her, had given birth to two daughters, which created tremendous resentment in her family. Her husband was beating her every day. He was a gambler. The family was in debt. Her mother-in-law was suggesting that her husband get another wife who might produce sons. And at that point, she got a $65 micro loan and started an embroidery business. And she turned out to be brilliant at embroidery. She started hiring other people in the village and eventually hired her husband. And this really
That'll do it.
It changed the dynamics in the family and in the village. Now there's no talk about getting another wife. And she's educating her daughter, so that they're going to have an entirely different future.
Great story, but is it scalable up?
It does seem to be. And Bangladesh is an example of scalability. If you compare Pakistan and Bangladesh, then there are some reasons for their different outcomes. But one is microfinance and one is educating girls. And today, because of that, Bangladesh is stable and has a much better future than Pakistan does.
Wow.
Nick and Cheryl, you work together. You also live together because you're married. How does that make an impact on what you do around the world? Are people looking at you as role models? Does it help or hinder your work?
Well, I would think that it certainly helps. I mean, I think actually the challenge is if you can raise kids together, then writing a book is really easy.
So. No kidding.
The book doesn't play you off each other.
I second that one, yeah. That's amazing. Well, one of the interesting things here about your work is that, if you look historically at when women have sort of gone from being, suppressed to empowerment. If you look at Europe at the end of the 1800s and the early 1900s, it caught fire very, very quickly. The women's suffrage movement was a dramatic change from the Victorian era. Do you think the possibility of women's empowerment catching fire as a global political movement is possible in our era?
Oh, I certainly do. I think that we're at a tipping point right now. And certainly within the country, the feel is like that, not only in the political sphere with the new appointments with the Women for Global Issues in the State Department with Hillary Clinton marshaling this idea, but also in the business sphere. You've got corporations now taking on this issue in their corporate responsibility areas and in the civilian population.
In Darfur, if women were more in control, would that have an impact on the genocide there? You've called it genocide.
Yeah. And look, I mean, there's no women aren't a magic bullet, but it is generally true that those societies where women are more marginalized, and that certainly includes Sudan, those are the ones that are more likely to have civil conflict and indeed genocide. I think that, more broadly, educating girls, bringing them into the labor force not only increases economic growth, but does provide greater stability.
And among the issues to be explored in the subject of your forthcoming book, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. The related article was in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wudun, thanks so much for joining us. Nick Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times and Cheryl Wudun, a former New York Times correspondent.
So Nick and Cheryl were talking about women's oppression as being a moral issue. One of the big moral debates we're having online at the moment is about healthcare. Visit thetakeaway.org, and when you're there, you can check in on our mini roundtable debates that we're having all this week. We'll be talking to different groups affected by reform, from doctors to small business owners, and also to Americans living abroad with a different experience of healthcare. Thetakeaway.org is the place to go.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Femi Okeh, and this is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.